What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, it's Dr. Will Cole. This podcast is the manifesto for a new breed of health seekers. This is The Art of Being Well. What is up, and welcome to The Art of Being Well. I am a leading functional medicine expert. I get to consult people around the world via webcam, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I wrote Intuitive Fasting, which is my newest book, and The Inflammation Spectrum, and Ketotarian. If you want to learn more about my clinical work, the telehealth center, the books, and there's lots of free resources there for you as well, you can check it all out at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. And listeners of The Art of Being Well, hear ye, hear ye. My proclamation. I am giving away free signed books of your choice. Pick whatever one you want. All you have to do is head on over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Art of Being Well. No matter when you're listening to this episode, my team and I will be going through Apple Podcast reviews and randomly picking a winner. You can leave your Instagram handle in the review if you want, or you can message me on Instagram at Dr. Will Cole and just say, hey, I left a review, and screenshot it if you want and send it over to me. And we'll be going through and picking winners throughout the years to come. So thank you so much. All right, let's get to today's guest. Why don't we? Her name is Katie Wells. She is the founder and CEO of Wellness Mama. I mean, who hasn't heard of Wellness Mama? She is a legend, to say the least. She is the founder and CEO of Wellness Mama and also wellness.com or wellness.com. You're going to learn so much about this. A mom of six with a background in journalism, she took health into her own hands and started researching to find answers to her health struggles. Her research turned into a blog and a podcast, and now she's written over 1,500 blog posts and counting, three books, and was named one of the 100 most influential people in health and wellness. When she's not reading medical journals, creating new recipes, or recording podcasts, you can find her somewhere outside in the sun with her husband, who, by the way, she met walking across the country, and kids, or undertaking some DIY remodeling project. Other random facts about this brilliant human being: she is a doula, she's a speed reader, she hates bananas, she loves baseball, she's a scuba diver, she's an INTJ on Myers-Briggs, and she's a highly experienced in answering the question, why? Stay tuned to the entire conversation, because at the end, I'll answer another one of your burning health questions in an Ask Me Anything. All right. This is Katie Wells, Art of Being Well. Katie, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get to chat with you more.
Oh, it's going to be so good. And for people that haven't heard yet, I'm on your podcast as well, so they definitely have to check that episode out. What's the name of your podcast before we get started?
Wellness Mama Podcast. It's easy. It's Wellness Mama everywhere online for me.
Awesome. So let's learn from the Wellness Mama. You are the icon of wellness. I don't think you even realized that, but you were having conversations within our space very early on where they're really, I mean, it's the industry is so much bigger now. But you were really one of the earlier voices online having these. Do you ever look back and think, dang, like what you started or what you were a part of?
It's so fascinating now to look back because it was never, I don't think, my plan to grow a brand or a community, but I think everything works out exactly as it should. And in hindsight, I started it from a point of pain myself, trying to figure out my own health answers, as I know many people in the health and wellness world have that similar story. And when I started 15 years ago, there just weren't, like you said, the number of resources available. A lot of this really wasn't being talked about. And I was doing my own research and having to, even things as simple as in my area, grass-fed beef, I was buying from a farmer in the back of his truck and it was kind of on the down low and there wasn't really organic food in grocery stores or a lot of supplements weren't available easily in a lot of places. And now, thankfully, there's so much more information and so much more availability of all of this. I think now we're in a time actually of learning to have to curate the information because we're so bombarded all day with all of the things we should do, quote unquote should do, that it's learning to cut through that. But I also learned early on, and when I became a mom, felt that very powerful sense of change inside that happens when you become a mother. And I realized there were a lot of moms, A, that were going through similar health issues or who had children going through similar health issues. So I wanted to share my research as I learned myself from very much a place of I'm learning, let's learn together. But I also firmly believe that moms are one of the most powerful forces on the planet. And I realized if we could support each other in community, that's when societal change happens. And for me, one of my pivotal moments was reading that statistic that for the first time in two centuries, the current generation of children will have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And I read that when my oldest was 6 weeks old and it lit a fire in me. I had no idea how, but I wanted to help change that statistic because that wasn't good enough for my kid or anyone's kid. And now we see, largely led by a lot of moms, this movement of making changes on a grassroots home level. And I think that's where we're actually going to see societal change happen too.
Yeah, man, that's so true. I mean, I think of all my patients and I think of all the stories I've heard in the industry for the past decade plus, where it is moms. Moms are really changing the conversation. I mean, even walking through the grocery stores. I mean, my mind goes to growing up in this weird world of wellness, even from an early age. I remember meeting the grass-fed beef guy in the parking lot or going to the farm. Like that's really, so much has changed in the past 15 years. So much has changed, let alone 20, 30 years. All right. So let's go into your health journey. I mean, since that was a catalyst for your own, for you then to become a voice for so many things and start conversations, you were diagnosed with Hashimoto's, but maybe even go before that diagnosis. There's so many people listening right now that have autoimmunity or know somebody with autoimmunity. What was your journey like in those early days?
Well, as we talked about when you were on my podcast, I think in hindsight, it's easy to see that the actual problem started far, far in advance of a diagnosis or even like what I would have correlated as symptoms that would make me think to get a diagnosis. And I joke, but only halfway, that the perfect recipe for autoimmunity was what I did for most of my high school and college, which was don't get enough sleep, eat really crappy food, be stressed all the time, be super type A, and just kind of like drive yourself into the ground. And then when you have that, to use your analogy, the bucket approach, when you've got your bucket full of all of those negative inputs, it doesn't take much for it to start overflowing. And I think for me, the final thing that started that process that I noticed was getting pregnant with my first child. And obviously lots of hormonal changes happened during that time. And afterwards, I started just noticing symptoms that weren't common or usual for me. And when I went to my doctor about it, I got that response many people get, which is, oh, this is very normal postpartum. All moms go through this. It's just in your head. You're fine. And then they say really fun stuff like, get more sleep. I'm like, oh, okay, with a newborn. Got it. Great. Good. It ended up being about an 8-year process for me to actually get a diagnosis. And in hindsight, I'm very, very grateful. I think often in life, the things that seem the hardest in the moment become our greatest teachers. And I'm so grateful to that experience for what I learned and for hopefully the benefit it's given to other people through me having to learn it and getting to research because of it. But it was a long process to get diagnosed. And then even after receiving the diagnosis, it was a long process to start to make improvement because it wasn't like I was just sitting around not doing anything waiting for a diagnosis. I was in the health world. I was in PubMed daily. I was reading the current research. I was lab testing. I was running everything through spreadsheets. My diet was dialed in and tracked. My supplements were dialed in and tracked. I was exercising. And yet I still could not lose weight after pregnancies. My hair was falling out. My eyebrows were thinning. I had all of these odd symptoms. My body temperature was low. And still, when I went to a lot of these conventional doctors at first, with all of that, they would say those things are just normal. And I'm like, it's not normal to have a body temperature in the 96s. And it's not normal. And can we test something besides just TSH? Can we test my antibodies? Can we test T3, T4 and all the other variables? And they would say, that's not needed because your TSH is fine. And it led me to the place I am now. And I think you'd probably agree of no one in the world does better research than a concerned parent, especially for the parents listening, you know, like, and I think there's been this swing and this like tension between practitioners and patients that doesn't need to be there. I've heard, especially conventional doctors, to say things like, don't confuse your internet research with my medical degree. And I responded, don't confuse your medical degree with my right to informed consent and my access to the same studies you can read. And I think the best outcomes happen when we have informed patients who are willing to do the research and put in the effort and be invested in their own health, working with practitioners like you who are willing to listen to the patient. And that's where we start to see the change. And that's what it was for me, was finding functional medicine and learning a whole different approach to root cause.
Wow, powerfully said. And I see the systemic delegitimization of people, especially women, but all types of people struggling with autoimmunity and different quote unquote mystery illnesses. Partly they're a mystery because no one's even looking at data. No one's even looking at labs. They're just saying you're just depressed or you're whatever, stressed out, and they're not even looking there. But that said, they are complex in many ways. And my patients are typically right where you were at the beginning. You were doing all the things, but you were still not where you wanted to be. For over a decade, Tappan has been the source for individual collectors and designers to find art for their homes as well as their clients. They connect collectors to the best established and emerging artists from around the world, including original works with limited edition prints. Tappan has revolutionized the art buying experience. You can find inspired works for your home by trusting the curation at Tappan. From selection to framing, buying art with Tappan is transparent and effortless. Tappan has been recognized as a leader in the industry by Architectural Digest, Vogue, Mindomain, and Coveteur. There's a lot of very interesting science around being around art and having art in your own home in the scientific literature. One study out of Norway found that people who were around art, that looked at art, that appreciated art, had improved rates of good health, satisfaction with one's life, and lower rates of anxiety and depression in both men and women. Use code WILLCOLE at checkout for $50 credits towards your first purchase at Tappan. That's tappancollective.com. That's TappanCollective. tappancollective.com to find your next work of art. Again, that's code WILLCOLE at checkout for $50 credit towards your first purchase. Electrolyte imbalances are ubiquitous when I'm looking at labs for patients. I see it so often with people that are struggling with fatigue, brain fog. They're just feeling moody and hangry. They're having cravings. They think it's some big thing they have to do, but it's really just if they just balance their electrolytes, all these things would be calm down, and they would feel amazing. Element, man, I love Element. I use it all the time. Element is a tasty electrolyte drink mix with everything you need and nothing you don't. It contains science-backed electrolyte ratios. Get this, 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, 60 milligrams of magnesium, all imperative to get the balance of these electrolytes right. With none of the junk, no sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no filler, no BS, no nothing that you don't want and all the things that you do want. Element is formulated to help anyone with their electrolyte needs and is perfectly suited to folks following a keto, low-carb, paleo diet. Just really, honestly, if you eat any way, this is a great supportive tool to get your electrolytes in. I recommended this for patients for years. I use it myself. And right now, Element is offering the listeners of The Art of Being Well, all of you fine people, a free sample pack with any purchase. That's 8 single serving packets free with any Element order. This is a great way to try out all their flavors
or share Element with a salty friend. We all have those, right? Get yours at drinkelement.com/Will Cole. This deal is only available through this link. That's drinkelement.com. drinkelement.com/Will Cole.
From the offices of Create and Cultivate, I'm Jacqueline Johnson, the host of Work Party, a podcast for ambitious women looking to create and cultivate the career of their dreams. Work Party is paving the way for a new generation of women, women who are redefining the meaning of work on their own terms. Every Wednesday, we bring in leading female powerhouses for real talk and BS-free advice on building your business. You'll hear from female founders, CEOs, entrepreneurs, creatives, and so many other badass ladies. Are you ready to create and cultivate the career of your dreams? Then tune into Work Party, the podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show and never miss an episode.
Can you talk about what are some pivotal points in your health journey that were bigger needle movers for you, that you didn't know, and when you started integrating them into your life, they really were a powerful tool for your health journey?
Absolutely. I think early on, it's laughable to look back and think how basic it seems now, but even the beginning step of realizing early on that food impacts us more than just calories, because I was raised with the more traditional idea of just calories and macros. And obviously it goes so much more beyond that, because food is giving chemical signals to your body. And even learning that was paradigm shifting for me. And that began an evolution. For a while, I was on a more restrictive AIP type diet just to help my body kind of reduce some of the inflammation that I realized was happening. And from there, I went more granular into getting my own labs and starting to I'm a big fan of self-experimentation, and I would try things one at a time and track to whatever degree I could if there was a change from that. But it took me a lot of years, because my research brain very much wants to go into the spreadsheets and the granular and systematize everything. And I also kind of ignored other aspects of that, thinking like, this is a physical problem, it needs a directly physical solution. And so in the past 3 years, the most paradigm shifting for me was actually addressing the nervous system side and the mental emotional side, which I didn't think was important until I experienced it. And now I would make the case it's probably the most important factor, or at the very least, if you don't address that one, the other ones won't be nearly as effective. And that was so profound for me that it was an inner shift. I realized I had been fighting my body for a very long time, trying to shame it and force it into doing what I wanted rather than working with it. And when I addressed the inner side, I read a beautiful quote that said, I said to my body, I want to be your friend. And it took a deep breath and responded, I've been waiting your whole life for this. And that was that moment for me. And when I shifted how I talked to myself and started addressing the trauma side and the spiritual and mental side, all of those other factors fell into place. And what I thought was this huge fight that had for me been what felt like a decade long fight to try to lose weight, to try to get my antibody numbers down, they all happened effortlessly in the span of about 8 months. And I've lost now close to 100 pounds without trying. I'm actually eating more. And this is the part I love to tell women. I went from like deprivation and shame and self-hate to now working with my body and nourishing it. And I'm eating more. I'm less restrictive. I'm having fun when I work out. I'm not punishing myself. And I didn't have to fight anymore. And I don't think that it's a silver bullet that you can just suddenly one day make a mental shift and everything falls into place. But I do think it's important to have awareness about that and start paying attention to how we speak to ourselves internally, because our body is listening and it's there to support us. But when we're giving it the wrong inputs, that's the program it's running.
Yeah. And fantastic. I definitely see that so much clinically. And I'm glad that we're shining light on this facet of mental, physical, bidirectional relationship between our thoughts and emotions and our physiology. And you, like you said, it's not a magic bullet. What did that journey look like with lots of ups and downs? I'm sure, and really nose to the ground, staying true to what you knew you had to do. But what was that timeline of healing look like for you?
Yeah, it was both in some ways very difficult and also very rapid. I see why in therapy often, or people like Byron Katie call it the work, because it does require work, or at least awareness. I think awareness is the big first step. But my story very candidly is that I had a very acute sexual trauma in high school. And I thought I had emotionally dealt with it, but what I had actually done was emotionally shut down huge aspects of myself to not have to face the pain of it, to the point that It's no exaggeration to say that for the first 12 years of having children, I never once, not ever raised my voice at them, even a little. Like I did not have big emotions. I did not cry for 14 years. Like I had shut down emotional aspects of myself. And I realized that in that moment, it wasn't actually the physical trauma itself that was so acute. It was the feeling of helplessness. And I think this is a common theme in trauma victims, that not being in control of one's own body or one's own reality can be very, very, very altering. And so I had built all these elaborate structures with this idea that I will never feel helpless again. And there's always a silver lining that made me highly effective at business and very regimented as a mom. And I got a lot of things done, but I wasn't fully in touch with myself. And I was constantly, I would guess, in a state of sympathetic nervous system for over a decade, probably without shifting into parasympathetic almost at all. And so I had to learn to start addressing that. And for me, there was a very somatic component, because often in sexual trauma victims, there's a detachment from the body. And that was what I experienced. And so I started inadvertently doing somatic therapies. I worked with a practitioner who did a version of Rolfing with something called acroyoga, which doesn't seem like a thing that would have been helpful. I think for me, it was a, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear and the teacher could look lots of different ways. But it put me in a situation where I was physically out of control of my body again, because I wasn't on the ground. And there was a somatic element. So I was reconnecting with my body. And in that moment, I had this like very altered experience and relived the trauma. And then when I finally got put down, I had what probably would have been great to have happen immediately after, which was I had the somatic and emotional processing of the trauma, where my whole body shook for hours, which is a normal adrenaline nervous system response. I often look at it now and say, you know, animals in the wild, when they have a near-death experience, they're not walking around with PTSD after. They somatically process it, and then they reintegrate it into their lives. And as humans, we have the capacity to not do that. But we're not working with our biology sometimes when we override our normal biological function. So I think I somatically processed it 16 years later, and then was able to start to integrate and at least have those things come out of the subconscious and into the conscious so I could work with them and accept them. And from there, I worked with a variety of different practitioners and incorporated practices like meditation and tapping and Qigong, things that like reintegrate with the body and that helped the body shift into parasympathetic. And that was when, in that really rapid span, I saw all those changes start to happen, very likely from a physiological perspective, because I wasn't just constantly in fight or flight or freeze. And I was able to actually start to rest and heal, which my body had been thankfully primed for, I think, because of all the research and the nutrition and all the work I had been doing. And then when I finally was able to integrate that one piece, it let my body start healing, which at the end of the day, I'm like, that's what the body is designed to do. It wasn't that any of those things healed me. It's that they got out of my way so my body could heal itself.
I love this. This is so important that we're covering this. I think when you were talking about not crying for a long time and these somatic experiences, and I've seen so many very powerful sessions with people going through these different somatic therapies where they let it all out, all the things kept in their bodies, kept in their cells, kept in their autonomic nervous system. It reminds me of this quote. I don't know if you've heard of it before, this quote before, but it's from Glennon Doyle. She said, crying is good. It's organic baptism. It's how we submerge and then begin again. It's kind of what you just were saying. What was that initial acro yoga Rolfing session? Was it just one time and that was like this big catalyst, or was it a series of sessions with this modality?
That was just
modality?
The one time that was a very acute, like reliving and then somatic integration. And I did do follow-up therapies with, there are now somatic trauma-informed therapists who are trained to help reintegrate that side. And so I did do follow-ups, but certainly like that moment was the big kind of tipping point that let the other work start happening. And I did work, I think often in trauma, it can be so varied. It can be early attachment. It can be a direct acute form of trauma, whether physical, emotional, sexual. It can be, I think, even generational stuff that gets passed on through our parents and grandparents. So I think it's a very multifaceted approach. And I do think when people come to me now, I say, I wish I could give you a blueprint, because I'll be like, what did you do? And I'm like, I can tell you, but you can't just replicate the system, because I also did that. I followed every expert system out there for 10 years and tried everything. You have to find what's going to work for you. And it's very multifaceted. But I'm a big fan of integrating things like the functional medicine approach to make sure you're listening to your body with things like therapy, with things like meditation practices, and experimenting, each of us experimenting to figure out what our own versions of that are going to be effective are. But it was very multifaceted for me, with somatic therapy, traditional therapy, and then a lot of practices that got me in parasympathetic.
Mm-hmm. That's great. People age at different speeds,
and the date on your license may not represent your inner biological age at all. If you're looking for ways to extend your health span and slow down the aging process, the keys to health and longevity run in your blood. That's why Inside Tracker provides you with a personalized plan to improve your metabolism, reduce stress, improve your sleep, and optimize your health for the long haul. Created by leading scientists in aging, genetics, and biometrics, Inside Tracker analyzes your blood, your DNA, and fitness tracking data to identify where you are optimized and where you are not. You'll get a daily action plan with personalized guidance on the right exercise for your body, right nutrition for your body, and supplementation for your body. What I also love about Inside Tracker is what they call Inner Age 2.0. You all have to check this out. You can add this to any plan for a definitive calculation of your true biological age. You are going to be shocked by the results. And you can see how you're aging from the inside out. For a limited time, get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. All you have to do is go to insidetracker.com/artofbeingwell. Again, that's insidetracker.com/artofbeingwell. Or you can use code WILLCOLE at checkout to get that 20% off. Our next partner has a product I've loved for years. You probably have heard of it because I am such a super fan. It's Athletic Greens. With one delicious scoop of Athletic Greens, you're absorbing, get this, 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens all in one to help you start your day right. Athletic Greens was created when the founder experienced a ton of gut health issues and ended up on a complicated supplement routine. And he wanted something that had all the things in one formula. In 2020, Athletic Greens purchased carbon credits that supports projects protecting old growth rainforests. And for every purchase, they donate to organizations helping to get nutritious food to kids in need, including No Kid Hungry here in the United States. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's all you have to do. To make it really easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1 year supply of immune supporting vitamin D. I'm looking at labs all day long for patients, and vitamin D deficiency is ubiquitous, and it's needed for your mood. It's needed for your immune system, and it's needed for energy levels. It's needed for regulating inflammation, so many things. And they're also going to give you 5 free travel packs of Athletic Greens with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/WillCole. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/WillCole to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. All right, so let's go. Something that I know that you dug into as a N of one experimenter and really leaning into this information is genetics. So can you talk to me about what you learned about genetics? I get asked that question a lot, like different gene SNPs that I'm looking at as a functional medicine practitioner. But for you, I know people want to geek out about this stuff. So what was your discovery in learning about your genetics?
Yeah, I love talking about this. And I think this is another area that in the last 15 years, we've had the availability of so much more data. I remember in high school, the day in science class when they told us that they had figured out how to sequence the whole human genome. And that wasn't that long ago. And now we have at-home tests that can give you so much data. And what I saw over time is early on, when I was interviewing people on the podcast and reading studies and books from people who were deep in genetics, I started to notice this trend that as we learned more, we tended to hyper-focus on certain genes, get really excited about them, and then do all this stuff directly focused on that one gene. And so an example would be like MTHFR became very popular. We were all talking about it. People were supplementing with huge amounts of methylfolate. And when I started really delving into it, I realized, obviously, we know the body is very complex and holistic, and it's never about a single factor. And I think in genes, we kept getting caught up in kind of the trendy ones at the time without realizing that when you hypersupplement methylfolate, you might be affecting 12 other genes positively or negatively. And I didn't see really any resources that were addressing the interaction of genes. And especially if you're going to take something supplemental in a dose that could be almost like pharmaceutical in nature by taking a big dose, it's important to be aware of the downstream effects of that. And so I'm a spreadsheet person, and I started building out these spreadsheets with all kinds of conditional logic that said, if I take this gene, what other genes, like let's put some if-thens in place and see what other genes are getting affected, and actually try to develop some ratios within standard deviations of what maybe to experiment with in a safe way, so we're not throwing other things out of alignment, and then kind of just inputting between that and my labs and my food intake and just keeping everything at a table for the experimentation of that. And I think we're close to seeing this on a more wide scale and available for all of us without having to build spreadsheets that take half an hour to load. But for me, that was the only option at the time. So I really started going granular on this and just realizing, just like we wouldn't want to necessarily jump into a pharmaceutical approach for any problem right away without taking other things into account, I think the same, in my mind, should be true for supplements, especially if you're taking them in big doses for a very targeted thing and basically using them as a drug. It's important to know how they're going to impact the body in other ways.
Mm-hmm. So what are some, because you, like you said, we cannot be so reductive. And I think many ways we can think of it as almost like genetic astrology, where it's like MTHFR is my sign. And yeah, it's so much more complex than that. And you could have, like you said, a dozen other genes that code to upregulate and help a slower MTHFR gene variant. But what are some of the genes that you found to be supportive, like of your specific health journey, just unique to you?
Well, I think you just made a very important point that applies to genes and also a lot of aspects of health, which is connecting our identity to any particular gene or diagnosis or currently existing condition, because they can all change. And I'm a big proponent that almost anything can at least be improved, if not completely reversed. And so I hear people say like, oh, I have MTHFR. And I'm like, that statement doesn't even make complete sense, because we all have genes that deal with MTHFR. Yeah. And even if you have the quote unquote really bad ones in your homozygous in them, that doesn't at all dictate what your body's going to necessarily do. There are so many ways to be supportive in that. So for instance, I have a lot of genes that are dependent on choline. And when I was in my autoimmune phase, I avoided eggs for a long time because my body got inflamed from them. So I had inadvertently created this very long-term choline deficiency. And so I was able to target and take certain forms of choline in combination and reverse that. I also have been watching my lab data and realizing that, back to the mindset piece, just because you have a gene factor doesn't mean it's expressing and doesn't mean it's causing a problem for you. And I was shocked to watch my labs when I didn't change anything else about my diet or lifestyle other than dealing with my nervous system and dealing with the spiritual mental side, to actually watch my lab numbers change. And I was really excited to be in the data so much, because I think often that factor gets really, really overlooked. But I think it's important to not identify with any condition, with any gene, and to make sure our inner languaging is positive and growth focused versus getting stuck in any of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really well said. Another topic that's not talked about enough, but you really have been talking about it for 15 plus years, and it is the products that we're using in our homes and the connection that it has to our health. So what are we doing wrong? What's the standard American doing wrong out there as far as the products that are, and not necessarily wrongs, maybe that's not the best word, but you know what I mean? They are unintentionally using products on a daily basis that could have potential problems. What's going on there?
Well, there's a lot going on, and I'm so glad you brought this up, because I think so many people now, because of the mainstream conversation, are pretty aware of the dietary stuff. And you do a great job of explaining the big ones to avoid and the important ways to make sure you're building your body. And when we eat food, we can often find that cause and effect relationship because we notice how we feel. I think it's a little bit more difficult to notice that exact relationship with things we come in contact to through air, through skin contact, because we don't necessarily feel the immediate impact of it, especially if it's low-level chronic exposure. But this is another really big area, because babies are now coming into the world with hundreds of chemicals in their cord blood. And the placenta is highly effective at keeping most things out. So the fact that babies are starting on day one with hundreds of chemicals in their body that many have not been tested for human safety should be a big red flag. Along with the fact that when they run the data, there's over 80,000 chemicals now used in cleaning and personal care products. And the vast majority of those have never been studied. And if they are studied, it's generally just they don't have acute toxicity. They're not going to kill you in small amounts. That doesn't mean they're long-term endocrine safe. And we know from the data that we're seeing a huge rise in things like precocious puberty, hormone problems in children, obviously chronic disease and hormone problems in adults. And we also know from the data that indoor air is often exponentially more polluted than outdoor air. And many of us now spend almost all of our time indoors. I know you and I talked about the importance of nature, and this is another area I would say it's so important just because indoor air can be really, really, really toxic and we don't necessarily realize it. And when you start really breaking down the big offenders, I'm a big fan of the 80-20 principle of we are never all going to live a perfect life. It's not possible. And the stress that we're going to create by trying is going to undo any of the positive effects, even if we could do it. But if we can take a high level kind of zoomed out 80-20 approach and figure out what are the inputs that are causing 80% of the damage, if we can just get rid of those, it doesn't usually take that much work. And we're making a huge shift in our lives. And so I think the chronic exposure piece is, I think, one that's being talked about more now. And it was a big focus for me, especially for moms who have small kids in the house. And the big offenders there tend to be household cleaning products, air fresheners and fragrances and artificial things like that, and then personal care products, and especially for women. Men have exposure also, but men use on average a tenth of the personal care products that women do. And the last stat I saw is that women are exposed to hundreds or thousands of chemicals a day through their personal care products. And if it's, whether it's scents in your laundry detergent and fabric softener, or whether it's things in your lotions, in your serums, and your makeup, those are sitting on the body and your body's interacting with them on a low level all day. So to tie that into the sympathetic parasympathetic equation, if you're interacting with those constantly through smelling them on your clothes or them touching your skin, you're getting that like kind of sympathetic nervous system response. The body's trying to deal with it. And you may never feel that or even know it's going on, but your body does. And we can get rid of so much of that by just making, now there's wide availability of cleaning products that are from concentrate that are safe, that you can use to make everything in your home. They're actually cheaper. So the cleaning one is super easy. There's almost like no excuse there and you're going to save money. The personal care one was tougher. And what for me was really striking was to realize I have friends and family members who prioritize eating organic food, who weren't using air fresheners in their home, who did a lot of the stuff you and I would talk about and were really careful about it. Their kids weren't eating food dyes or vegetable oils, but they were still using things like traditional personal care products and toothpaste because we've come to expect a certain feel from that and we want them to work. And even those of us who are very motivated to live a healthy life, we don't want to look bad and we don't want to go around with our hair looking bad or feeling bad or our teeth yellowing from glycerin and toothpaste just for the sake of natural. And those seem to be the ones where people would not make the switch because there weren't better alternatives. So my thought was, I've been making these things at home for the exact same reason because I couldn't find ones that worked. And this seems like a pain point for other families. And when it comes to personal care, if you can switch your hair care, your deodorant, and your toothpaste, that's your 80-20. That makes a difference of getting rid of 80% of your chemicals with only 20% change. And then you can address the rest from there if you want to. But if not, at least you've made that huge shift and it's an everyday shift without extra effort. Because that's the other thing in health. Any of us who have to go on a restrictive diet or a certain protocol, that requires effort. I'm a big fan of changes that don't require conscious effort, which is just switching a product you're already using or anything you can do that's improving while you're sleeping because you're not doing anything to make that change. I love, for instance, the chili pad because I turn it on. I don't have to do anything. It's helping me while I sleep and it's not requiring any motivation, effort, or decision-making.
It's so cool. And you've been, like you mentioned, giving us for 15 plus years, DIY, like at home, affordable peas and formulas to make these personal care products. And now you put, and many people don't do that at home. They're overwhelmed, it's inconvenient, they want something convenient they could buy online. And you came out with a line of personal care products. Like what, tell people the reasoning behind that, like what was the impetus and what products are out so far?
Absolutely. So, and all those recipes to your point are still there. I'm still a huge fan of people making their own. I also realized my full-time life is mom and health and wellness world. So this is literally what I get to do every day. And that's not true for a lot of people who are also balancing full-time careers and everything else that comes along with life. So the recipes will always be there for anyone who wants to make them. And they're very, very cost-effective that way. But I realized most people just want to be able to make a switch. And they just want to be able to order something, have it arrive in 2 days, like we're all used to from Amazon, and make the switch in their house without the effort. And so when I was looking at that, I was like, these are the ones that people would have the most trouble making, that would be the most complicated to make, and that if they could just make the switch, would make the biggest difference. And the really hero product for me was the toothpaste, because as part of my autoimmune journey, I went through a phase where I was like pretty nutrient depleted. And I started getting a bunch of cavities. And that led into reading things like nutrition and physical degeneration. And then a lot of the works that spurred from that, and realizing, well, we had been told that teeth can't regenerate, and that once you have a cavity, you always have a cavity. That wasn't entirely true. And when we looked at all these other populations, A, they didn't really get any kind of dental decay like we do in the modern world. They didn't need braces like we do in the modern world. And that we could use some of the ideas and research from that to actually both keep our mouths strong and healthy, and also even improve minor cavities. And I've now talked to many experts who understand this, dentists who have come on and said, yeah, remineralization is absolutely possible, but some of our current dental products actually get in the way. And the very like simple explanation being, there's a very cool complex interaction between things like fat-soluble vitamins in our body and the minerals we consume and interact with in our saliva and the teeth enamel. And so it actually is possible to not just support, but even help the body regenerate enamel up to a certain point. And so I did this huge deep dive into remineralization and realized there's a way to support this. Obviously, we want to support it through diet as well, make sure we're getting nutrients, especially fat-soluble vitamins. But layered on that, you can actually support topically through the mouth. And so that was what our toothpaste was built around, using a mineral called hydroxyapatite, that is what the body naturally uses in tooth enamel, and making sure it's present in the saliva by using it in the toothpaste. And then avoiding things like detergents that actually strip away the beneficial bacteria in the mouth and the protective mechanisms in the saliva, and instead putting in natural ingredients that help. Because there's also a really fascinating balance between different bacteria in the mouth. We all know about the gut microbiome now. There's also an oral microbiome. And if it gets imbalanced in either direction, you end up with a problem. A lot of people don't realize things like cavities and gingivitis don't exist in the same at the same time. You have one or the other because they're different bacteria out of balance. So I developed this formula that was based around hydroxyapatite for remineralization, and that had different natural herbs that would keep those bacteria in balance so that you would hopefully avoid both of them. And that then would support the body's natural remineralization process. And to me, it always goes back to just supporting the body and what it does naturally. We don't have to do anything to really alter this. We also know from the research that what goes on the body goes in the body, which to me is a very obvious reason to avoid the toxic stuff. And that should be the baseline, as we avoid putting the toxic stuff on our body. But the other side to that is you can use this as an opportunity to put beneficial things on the body and receive the benefit all day long. And so for that reason, our toothpaste, you don't have to spit or like rinse your mouth out after, because you can actually leave those minerals directly on the teeth while you're sleeping. Same thing with the shampoo conditioner. They're meant to be hair food. A lot of shampoo contains really harsh detergents that actually strip away the proteins and oils in your hair. And instead, we said, what can we put in that shampoo that feeds the scalp, that nourishes the body, that not only doesn't put toxins on it, that should be obvious, but that gives it something beneficial while you're sleeping and during the day. So instead of low-level dangerous chemical exposure, you're getting low-level beneficial exposure all day.
Oh, wow. So cool. So you have the shampoo, conditioner, you have a hand sanitizer that I use as well.
Hand sanitizer, toothpaste, dental floss, and then now children's toothpaste, charcoal toothpaste, and soon to be deodorant.
Very cool. Anything else you could tell us? Like, what's in the pipeline? Your dream products that haven't come out yet?
Yeah, I wanted to tackle all the family essentials. So we've got soap now, and then we're working on longer term things like all the lotions and facial care as well. But I wanted to tackle the ones that everybody uses every day, just so that those simple switches could happen. And then we could do that 80-20 with personal care products. And then from there, we're going to get really exciting with some of the new ones.
Very cool. And we'll put the links in the show notes for everybody. So speaking of families and care products, you have 6 kids, which is so impressive. I have 2 and I can't imagine 6. Like, you are a superhero for me. So what are your kids' ages, and how do you, many parents listening to this are thinking like, okay, I want to make these positive changes for my kids' life so they don't have to go down the road that I've gone through and had to go learn it the hard way. And they want to start as early as possible. So what are the rules in the family home as far as living a healthy, safe, non-toxic life.
Yeah, well, I will say, I think two kids can be a lot tougher than six. I think four was for me the easiest number, but I think we each get what we're supposed to have and it worked out well in my house. But ages right now are 5 to 15. So I had them all pretty close together. And I had that same focus of how can I help my kids avoid these health problems that I had? How can I help them have these foundational skills early on? And that's become very multifaceted. I even homeschool because I saw that as a issue in education as well. But I think part of it is from the very beginning, building these things in as education principles in a very non-scary way and non-controlling way. I'm a big believer that kids understand so much more than we often give them credit for. And I'm a big believer in giving them autonomy as much as possible in a safe way from a very, very early age. And then setting things up where they learn natural consequences in a safety net of a home environment, but also leave home as fully functional humans who can do everything they need to do. And so one of my core principles with them is that I don't do anything for them that they're capable of doing themselves, including once they are physically capable of doing their own laundry, they do their own laundry, which is usually around age four. And I don't do it for them anymore. This was a progression for me as well. I'll address the food side first, because I think this is a big one. People ask a lot of questions related to that. And how do you make your kids eat healthy food? Or how do you keep your kids from eating unhealthy food? Or how do you get them to do these things? And the answer is, I think there's a division of responsibility that's very easy and obvious, which is that I'm the parent who has to buy the food. So my responsibility is to make sure there's an availability of nutrient-dense food, and also to over time teach them how to cook and prepare their own food. Their responsibility as children is to listen to their bodies, to eat when they're hungry, and to get to have autonomy in what they do and don't like. However, that doesn't mean I'm becoming a short order cook. So my responsibility is to prepare nutrient-dense food. Their responsibility is to decide if they're going to eat it or not. And they always have the freedom not to eat it, whether it be because they don't like it or they're not hungry, but I'm not making them something else just because they don't like it. I find like hunger is a great teacher. And I think also if we don't go into it with the expectation that kids do or don't like certain foods or that there are certain kid foods, they don't really develop the weird tendencies that they often can. And the other side of that for me is I don't restrict food. I think anything we overly restrict can become attractive just because it's restricted. So while we only have nutrient-dense food in our house, if they go to a friend's house, I make no effort at all to control what they eat. I educate them. We talk about food and how it benefits the body or how it can harm the body. But when they're not home, it's their responsibility to decide if they're hungry and what they're going to eat. And often, especially when they're first learning that, they'll choose something that wouldn't have been my choice. And often they feel an effect from it because they're not used to eating it. And then they choose not to do it again. But that's not me externally enforcing that. That's them learning their own inner compass related to listening to their body, which from a lifelong perspective is going to benefit them much more. Yeah. Same with other aspects of parenting. Any way that I cannot externally enforce something, but help them intrinsically learn it, I'll always focus on that. So that's just kind of my overarching checklist that I go through with every aspect of parenting.
I love it. So how do you navigate? I have a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old at the time of us talking right now. How are you navigating technology? I mean, our kids are around the same age, the older ones. It's tough in the world that they're in. My kids are homeschooled as well, so it's like a little bit easier, but they're still very socialized and they're around all their friends that have technology. So it's a personal decision, but for you, for your family, how do you guys navigate that?
It's another great question. So I think it is personal responsibility, but I think it's also, there's an aspect of they will listen to some of what we say. They'll pay attention to a lot more of what we do. And also where is the personal responsibility line within that equation? So you and I are on technology right now. Our kids see us interacting with technology all day, and it's highly likely that technology is going to be a piece of their adult life. So I always thought complete avoidance of technology is not only not possible, it's probably not helpful to them because they're going to have to learn how to interact with it. But there's the education component, just like there is with food. So making sure from a young age, they understand that there can be positives and negatives associated with technology, that I'm modeling it from a young age so that they see me using technology to work, to order groceries for our family in beneficial ways. And they also see me put it down when family time is more important, and that my phone is not always attached to me. And that when I want to spend time with them and they're the priority, that I make them the choice over the technology so that they see and can make that same choice when it comes to family time. And then beyond that, my thing, just like with the food, is my responsibility is to provide for them, give them food, a place to live, and tools to reach their goals. But I don't consider a phone of their own an inalienable right in any way. So on the education side, I basically reimagined education from the ground up when my oldest was 5, realized that none of the existing programs out there really prepare kids for an uncertain future. My job right now didn't exist when I started school. And so there was no way to directly have prepared for it. However, there's things that are universals, like creative thinking, critical thinking, ability to solve problems, and in today's world, ability to learn rapidly because all the information is there. We need to learn how to synthesize it, curate it, and learn what we need to learn rapidly. So how do I help them prioritize those skills? And part of that was building in an entrepreneurship component to their daily lives and to their schooling, because they see, again, the modeling, they see me running a business, multiple businesses now, and they see me that as part of my life. I wanted to give them those foundational skills. Even if they choose as adults not to be entrepreneurs, I think a lot of valuable life lessons are learned through the process of entrepreneurship. So on the technology side, we have a contract with our kids that they can't have a phone or a car until they have a profitable business for 1 year. It doesn't have to make millions of dollars. It just has to be profitable for 1 year. And we have a home phone, like a cell phone that stays at home. So if they're babysitting the younger ones, they can call if they need to, but they're not just on social media until they've proven that they know how to use it as a responsible tool. And then they're using it to run their businesses. So it actually serves a purpose. And there's still, of course, guidance and limitations. And I make sure they're not, you know, running into hopefully too bad of stuff on the internet. But to me, that was a way to kind of balance that personal responsibility. And then now they have a profitable business that allows them to buy a phone and buy a car and understand the financial responsibility associated with those things.
Super smart. I love it. I have so much to learn from you, Katie Well. This is good stuff. All right. So as you know, the podcast is called The Art of Being Well. We've learned a lot about your art of being well already, but I want to just throw your favorite things. I'm going to ask you a question. This is Wellness Mama's, Katie Wells, Art of Being Well. First question is, you're stuck on an island and you are looking for nutrient density and survival, but you only had one food. What's that food?
Oh, that's a really tough one. I think it's a tendency. It's hard to like choose ever one because eventually, as you know, you're still going to run into nutrient deficiencies. For me, probably it would be some version of animal meats of some kind and or a liver, which is a thing I do pretty often is just eat raw liver and just swallow it for the nutrient density. But I realize that's not a necessarily popular opinion. But I think with just a few foods, you could easily, it could be like fruit, meat, and some kind of healthy oil, or you could do it easily with three foods, but one food does make it tougher.
The liver is very nutrient dense. What comes to mind for me is coconut, because you have like the coconut water, the meat, the fats, protein, all that stuff.
That's a good, ironically, to tie in the gene conversation. So when I was on the autoimmune diet, I couldn't do a lot of like dairy or other sources of that kind of stuff. So I went almost exclusively coconut for a long time before I learned the gene side. And the whole bioindividuality, I realized I don't do actually great with saturated fats or now coconut products. I sort of developed an intolerance to coconut by doing too much for too long. But I think overall, it's an awesome choice.
Yeah, great. All right, next question, completely opposite side of the spectrum. If you're looking at purely on deliciousness and taste, decadence even, let's remove the health benefits aside. What's that food for you that you really love? It could be healthy, it doesn't have to be.
Ooh, probably beef tartare. I started making it at home a long time ago, and from just like flavor and taste, I love it.
Wow, so you really are getting those organ meats in and loving it as well. I love it. All right. Next question. What are two supplements that have been the biggest game changers for you personally?
Magnesium and choline.
Any specific type of magnesium?
I experimented a lot and you might even be able to explain this better than I can even understand it. But when I first started taking magnesium, I started having almost like histamine-like reactions. Hmm. And I think maybe I was either super deficient or it was activating pathways that had not been very efficient. Yeah. Once I got past that, I do better with most forms of magnesium, but I find glycinate and threonate are the most effective for me personally.
Very cool. What's the biggest wellness myth that you wish people would just know the truth on?
Ooh, that's a great one. I wish I had thought time to think to prepare for this one. I think it's just, and we talked about this on your episode with me, if people want to listen to it, you explained it really well, but I think we have this human tendency to want to identify with different things and to like find our tribe and associate with that. And I see this play out in diet over and over. And I think it's that tendency to like over dogmatize diet and make it into a religion. Mm-hmm. I think the goal in my mind should be to be very adaptable and metabolically flexible and able to interact with anything in your environment or eat anything occasionally that you want to, versus having to be so strict and dog. And there is absolutely a time and a place for those more restrictive diets. I'm not against them at all. I just think when they become part of our identity, we can often get stuck in them. And so I think just that, like, getting stuck in a piece of that versus just really focusing on the body's ability to adapt and heal.
Yeah, well said. Toxic tribalism in any space, this is just within wellness, it becomes a religion for people and very negative and divisive. Very, very true. All right, next question. What's the latest non-food, non-supplement, like wellness tool or biohack that you're really into?
Well, it's probably the oldest tool in the book. I'm a huge fan of sunlight. I think we've unfairly demonized sunlight, and that small amounts of sun exposure throughout the day multiple times is actually one of the best medicines out there, because our bodies are also very, very light dependent. But to that end, the one I noticed the biggest difference from personally is just getting outside as soon as possible after waking up. And also, I never thought I'd be the person giving this advice, but getting up as close to sunrise as possible. I was always a night owl, love to sleep in. And I've had so many people come on my podcast and say, this is the best thing you could do for your brain. This is the best thing you could do for your hormones. And I resisted it for a long time, but that one is free. It doesn't cost anything to wake up and go outside. And I see a huge change in my labs when I do that consistently.
Love it. All right. Next question. What's one spiritual practice or mindfulness practice that has helped you the most?
Ooh, I would say meditation in general is the one that would help me the most. But I also, that's a thing I didn't understand or integrate well for a very long time, because being very type A, I had this misconception that meditation meant turning off the brain, which is actually not possible for me. And I was trying to do it sort of the wrong way for a really long time. I think there's a ton of different ways that you can incorporate this. And I think the goal is actually like an integration of all the parts of ourselves, the ability to just downshift and be for a minute so that we can enter a parasympathetic state. And I think often that can look like movement at times, whether it's a focused breathing breathwork practice, whether it's something like Qigong, that's actually a very active movement that lets you reconnect with your body. For me, it involved kind of a more multifaceted approach, but I think having some kind of practice, whatever that looks like, is a huge important key.
Got it. I'm curious about your answer here. What's your favorite restaurant in the world? If you go out to eat, but what's your favorite restaurant in the world and what do you order?
Ooh, so I very rarely go out to eat. I think probably my favorite that I've ever been to, there was an amazing restaurant in Greece, and it was just like this small restaurant that was owned by a family. And I think it really highlights how important the quality of food is, the sourcing, but also the preparation, because it wasn't a Michelin star rated restaurant. There's probably a million restaurants like that in Greece, but often I would tie it into this. I've had people come over to my house before and say things like, why does food taste so much better when you cook it? And I've noticed myself, man, food tastes so much better when I don't cook it, even if it's not usually in a restaurant, but a friend's house or somewhere else, even if I don't know the quality of it. And one time another friend who was there said, it's because it's cooked with love. And it sounds esoteric and ridiculous, but when something is cooked and prepared with love, it actually is different. And it's like, it almost like energetically takes that on. I have no scientific way to back that up, but I think maybe that's what made this particular restaurant that was immemorable in every other way so special, was that it was family owned. There was three generations all there together cooking in the back with food that was sourced right there. And I think that's what made it special.
That's so cool. Where in Greece was it?
I traveled all over Greece last year, actually. This one was in Nafplio, which is a little fishing town. And I had literally just roasted vegetables and feta and seafood. And it was phenomenal.
Great. What's your favorite way to exercise?
This has been a fun journey for me the last couple of years. So I went from thinking I hated exercise and was not an athlete, and it was a like punishment I had to do, to really shifting and now viewing it as play, largely through my best teachers, who are my kids. So they've all gotten into pole vaulting, which is not what I thought I would be doing after having six kids. But it turns out it's a phenomenal exercise, because you have, I think, the most fun exercises are balance of power and speed, and also balance and stability. And so in pole vaulting, you hit all of those. But for me, that also springboarded into a regular sprinting practice and also regular weightlifting practice, which both of those, if you look at the data, I know you know as well as I do, are really great for longevity, because you're keeping your bone strength up, you're keeping your lean muscle mass up. But then lately, I've been getting into even just learning to play with things like the more gymnastic side of things, and like the vestibular upside down stuff that still feels really scary to me, but just the play. And even things like, I've never been a distance runner. I don't plan to be a distance runner, but I set an experiment this year to run at least one 10K just to have done the distance piece. Because I think, just like with food, it's about the flexibility and your body being able to handle whatever you throw at it and adapt. And my main fitness goal is just that I want to be able to, if I ever needed to, run far enough to take care of my kids, or sprint somewhere if I need to get somewhere fast, or climb anything in my normal environment, and just be very, very functional with the goal of, I want to like toss my great grandkids in the air one day and that looks like a kettlebell swing. So maybe I'll train like that.
I love it. So cool. I'm learning so much about you. And you mentioned about me like being prepared for this. Part of the fun is just to see what comes to people's minds without telling you what I'm going to ask you. All right. Next question is, what's the weirdest wellness thing you've ever done that you're willing to share on a podcast?
I feel like there are not many I have not tried from all the different kinds of IVs. I've done the EBO2 where they take your blood out and UV it and ozonate it, to all of the liver cleanses, coffee enemas, all the, like I said, raw liver every morning, most days. I don't know what, like I've done all of the weird ones. I don't know what I would say is the weirdest one. I just would say there's probably no weird one I haven't tried at this point.
I love
Except
it.
Except for urine therapy. I have not drank my own urine yet.
Hey, 2022. Year. What's a book that you've read in the last year that it could be fiction, nonfiction, that's just really got you thinking in a new way or really inspired you in a different way?
I'll give two. One on the fiction side, because I didn't read fiction for a long time. It was very much in the research heavy side. And I loved the Red Rising series just for like pure entertainment. It was so fascinating and well-written. And then very recently in the last month, I read a book called Wanting, which is about mimetic desire in the modern world. I was already familiar with mimetic desire and mimetic theory through Rene Girard and Peter Thiel, and they both talk about it. But he really breaks it down and explains it in a clear way and points out a lot of examples in modern society. And I feel like humans are mimetic creatures, so you're never going to be able to like fully detach from that. But you tend, like awareness being 80% of it, I now see examples of that mimesis playing out in society in new ways.
Mm. Mm, beautiful. And I read somewhere that you are an INTJ, right? Is that true?
The architect, yeah.
Yeah, I am as well. I am well.
That's a rare one. That's
surprising. We're twins. Do you know anything about the Enneagram? Do you know what Enneagram you are?
It depends on when I test. I usually test an 8 or a 3.
Interesting.
But the challenge,
I don't know much. I have a few on my team. I have a few challengers on my team. But I don't know a lot about the Enneagram, but I'm curious about it, learning more. Katie, this has been a great conversation. Where can people get more plugged into your work, get the products that we talked about? Where do they go?
Well, the products are all at wellness.com, which is wellness with an E on the end. And everywhere else online, I'm Wellness Mama. So that's the name of the podcast, the website, all the social media, and lots more coming there this year. I would love for people to connect. I have a newsletter called Wellness Wednesday, where I put things like the books I'm reading and recent research I found that's fascinating and a bunch of discounts to sales. So people are welcome to join that list and hear from me once a week.
Thank you so much, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
At the end of every episode, I'll be answering a question from one of you guys. Nothing is off limits. Ask me anything. And you can send your questions over to me on Instagram or Facebook. As a functional medicine practitioner, it's been fun seeing the questions that have already come in on different food philosophies, wellness trends, and ways to approach overall mental, emotional, and physical health and well-being. Thanks for those. And I'm looking forward to seeing what else is on your mind. Now it's time for another Ask Me Anything. Today's question is from Michelle. Michelle asks, what are some of the genetic variants that you look at with patients that have autoimmune conditions and chronic fatigue? And do they actually matter, or is it mostly lifestyle? Very good question, actually. Well, depending on the person that you're looking at, every case is different, right? That's the caveat that I have to put here. But generally speaking, it's estimated that a third of this autoimmune inflammation spectrum equation puzzle piece, about a third of it is due to genetics. And then two-thirds, the majority, is largely due to epigenetics, the lifestyle things that influence genetic expression. Now, there are definitely exceptions to that. And even that genetic, epigenetic spectrum exists on a spectrum, meaning that the Venn diagram, the pie chart, can look different for different people, certainly. Some of the gene variants that we look at are methylation gene variants, things like MTHFO, we look at MAO, we look at COMT, we look at VDR. These are different letters, acronyms, right? That code for, they are named after a gene that makes an enzyme that does different things within methylation. And methylation is needed for healthy detoxification pathways, healthy hormone, healthy
hormonal signaling, healthy brain function, a lot of different, very complex, far-reaching, influential factors to how we feel, our mood, and the way our body is regulating itself. So we look at those gene variants. There's, and you can have different SNPs or SNP. Those are single nucleotide polymorphisms. And we get a copy from my mom and a copy from my dad. And look, geneticists spend their entire career looking at these things. And there are copious amounts of studies in the scientific journals looking at different methylation gene variants because it's just so embedded within human health. So to reduce the complexity of methylation in just this AMA, we'll never do it justice. And let me just say that it is very, very complex. Another gene variant that we look at with patients is something called the HLA gene, which stands for the human leukocyte antigen. It's basically how your body regulates the immune system and how your body responds to different inflammatory processes. It was originally estimated that about 25% of the population was a carrier for something called the HLA-DR gene. And that alone, even if you take the 25% scenario, that's about 80 million people in the United States alone. And some studies even point up to 40 to 60% of people around the world are impacted by these specific HLA-DR gene variants, which people that have these gene variants are more prone to chronic inflammatory problems. They're more prone to be somewhere on this autoimmune inflammation spectrum. It's very much associated with people that have mycotoxin problems, or they're sensitive to mold toxins, just largely the umbrella of biotoxins, which are basically going to be mold toxins, mycotoxins, chronic Lyme disease and co-infections, people that have underlying gut problems, people that have chronic viral reactivations. They almost always will have some sort of gene variant that has to do under the HLA umbrella. So that is definitely something that I look at, because these people, are their immune systems not regulating itself appropriately? So whenever they get exposed to to Lyme bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi, or Babesia, or Bartonella, or they're exposed to mold toxins, whereas if you didn't have that gene variant, your body could methylate and detox and clear that stuff out, and the immune system could handle it. The immune system isn't going to be triggered with this sort of chronic hypervigilant response. But these people that have these HLA-DR-DQ gene variants, they get exposed to these things and it really triggers an inflammatory response that has a difficult time calming down. And they're kind of stuck in that hypervigilant inflammatory response, and their nervous system ends up being stuck in a sympathetic fight or flight response. So that is the heart of my work, is to look at the methylation and the HLA gene variants and how that triggers the inflammatory response and the interplay between genetics and epigenetics. Like, we have a lot of work to do from an epigenetic side of things, like cleaning up their gut, cleaning up their diet, lowering inflammation levels, but also supporting these gene variants. But the genetic response and the way that the body's staying in that hypervigilant response can't really calm down until you start to clean everything up on the epigenetic side of things. So there's a lot of influence we have. Even if you have these gene variants, you still wield a lot of agency on your health. So don't be dismayed if you have that. And it's not as, I cannot be so reductive to say, well, because you have these gene variants, that means you're going to get that. I mean, there's a lot of people that have different gene variants and they don't even know it because they're completely fine. So this is not predestination over your life and saying you are doomed because you have this gene variant. But if you are exposed to these things and your immune system is in a hyperinflammatory state, well, genetics may be a component to why you feel the way that you do. And we have to look there to understand this full puzzle between genetics and epigenetics. Hopefully this clarified everything. If you want to learn more about what I do in this realm of telehealth, just go to drworldcole.com, go over to the consultation tab. You can check it out there. Thanks again for listening to The Art of Being Well. If you have a chance, please rate and review the podcast here. And if you like what you're hearing, hit follow and pass it along to a friend. To see more, head to drwillcole.com/podcast. I'll be back every Monday and Thursday, and I hope you will too. Talk soon.